We want to talk about Torah economics and finish up this series with a discussion on offerings and tithes. And it's sort of apropos that we talk about this week, because what was the big news this past week? It was Romney's. It was George Romney. Mitt Romney's. Mitt Romney and his tax returns, and they found out from his tax returns that the guy actually does pay 10% of his income in tithes, and to the Mormon Church. And if you listen to any commentaries or commentators about it, some of them were saying, "Well, this guy, you know, he's more generous than the Democrats, because there's not been a Democrat who's turned over his tax return in the last like 20, 30 years that gives over about 1 or 2% to any type of charity." But then the pundits are out there saying that, well, this guy gives 10% of his income to this church. That means that church is going to control him. And so that's the way they're looking at it. They don't look at it as, man, this guy is really, you know, he does what he says he's going to do, at least in that regards, you know. So anyway, they made a big deal of it, and tithing was somewhat of a discussion this week. They had a little thing on Fox News that I watched on it, and they don't really know what to think of a person that gives 10% of their income to anybody. But that's not necessarily what we're going to talk about today. In the first two sessions in this series, we talked about how the children of Israel were required by God to take care of the poor. And we found out that in all the economic mandates that God gave Israel, that taking care of the poor was the first and foremost thing that God had the children of Israel do. But this particular talk here, in fact, the first two sessions, that's all we talked about is taking care of the poor. And briefly we talked about gleaning, we talked about indentured servitude, we talked about loaning money to people, buying someone's land, and all of that. There's a number of things that God gave us in order to help us understand what he intended. But in all of those cases, he was very vague in a lot of this. He left it up to the individual to determine how they were going to help provide for the poor person. But as we go on and start studying into the income end of the Torah economics, it's sort of important for us to take and realize that Israel went through a number of changes in their governmental structure. And with each of these changes, the laws pertaining to how income was going to be provided changed. And so we're going to go through this real quick and look at these. The first 2 months after Mount Sinai, after they came out of Israel, I'm sorry, the first 2 months out of Israel came out of Egypt, they were set up as a different type of nation than what they later became. At the beginning, Yahweh was their king. He was the one who they all looked to as leader. He was the one who had saved them. He was the one who brought them out of Egypt. And so they looked to them as him as king. And then when they got to Mount Sinai, God established them as a nation. And when he established them as a nation, he established it like this. There was Israel, and then within Israel, there were priests and judges. So God was king, and everybody else was simply everybody else. Because it was from everybody else that some people had the role of priests. In fact, all of the firstborn, according to Exodus 19, all of the firstborn were priests. And then we also know, based on Exodus 18, that some of those people were called to be judges. And as the groups grew bigger, small groups came together, you would have a sort of a hierarchy in judges. But it was never really a pyramid-type structure like we've come to see in many groups. It was basically Israel, and everybody in Israel was equal. It's just they had different roles. And so the farmer, the shepherd, the goldsmith, the builder, any of those people really weren't any more important than the priests and the judges. They were just different roles. Every family basically had a priest in their family. So in you know, Jim's family, Jim would be the priest as the father, and then his firstborn son would be a priest also. And it would always work out that way, that the father would be a priest, and then the firstborn was called to be a priest. And the reason for that is that the father died, then the firstborn is the one who took over for the family while the family was still intact and all the children hadn't scattered off. And so God set that situation up, that system up. And in that system, we'll notice that there is no standing army, there is no church, and there is no government assistance. And the reason there wasn't is because all of these things were taken care of individually. The family had its own priest in their family. The clan was judges, and it sort of worked out that way. So you didn't have this big hierarchy or any of that, because God just set it up that way. But it didn't last very long. We know because Moses went up on top of the mountain after the covenant was accepted by the Israelites. Moses went back up on the mountain to receive further instructions, and he delayed coming back down. At least that's the way the Israelites thought. And they ended up building a golden calf. And as a result of the golden calf, the governmental structure changed somewhat. And so after the golden calf, we still have Yahweh as king. And then we still have Israel. And Israel is still judges, and they're still farmers, and they're still shepherds, goldsmiths, builders, and all that stuff. But something has changed, because now the common Israelite is no longer a priest. And so God's established the priesthood. And he called the Levites to be priests instead of the firstborn of Israel. And because of God called them, then something had to change in regards to the economics. Because where before the firstborn were priests, but they are also farmers, and they are also ranchers, and they are also goldsmiths and builders, then the priest had an occupation. But now when that God called the Levites to be priests, the Levites' occupation was being a priest. So what did that require? That required that the Israelites now had to start funneling money to the Levites. Before, there was no need to funnel money to anybody. Now, the common Israelite person had to start sending money to the Levites, to support the Levites. Keep in mind now that we've already discussed the poor and how the poor were all dealt with, so we don't have to deal with that in this discussion. But even in that situation, we still had no standing army, and we had no government assistance, because the assistance for the poor was taken care of by all the Israelites individually.
So, what about the
judges? The judges were never judges never got paid for anything. The judges were just people. They were just Israelites. Okay, so after about 400 years, the system changed again. And we know the story. Samuel was the prophet and the judge. And then all of a sudden, the Israelites decided they wanted to have a king. And so they established a king. Yahweh was still ultimately in charge over Israel. And within Israel, you still had farmers, shepherds, goldsmiths, builders, and et cetera. In other words, you had people working, producing. But now you start having layers. Okay, now just below, I just for analogy's sake, I stuck it down there a little bit. But now you have a king and a judge. The people no longer are judges per se, because now the king is the judge. We know that because, for instance, Solomon became the judge over the people. And of course, as Samuel told the people, when you have kings, you have armies. And so now, where before, when God was their king, they had no need for an army. Now they have to have armies. And then we still have the system of the Levites. So now, whereas before, when God called Israel out of Egypt, when there is no money flowing in all different directions, now all of a sudden we got money flowing everywhere. Well, I call it money. You had to supply the army. You had to supply the king. The king doesn't do his job for free, you know. He wants palaces and all that stuff, so he needs money. And then, of course, then there are the priests and the Levites that have to be taken care of, because that's another full-time group of people who can't be out there farming on a day-to-day basis. They're there in the there to assist the king. But at least we don't have any government assistance, because God still took care of that from the get-go. So do we see the differences, what happened, the metamorphosis, you might say, of Israel, and how all of a sudden there needed to be money going places where God never intended money to go? All right, good. Well, let me see here. With all this in mind, we want to take and study the various income streams that goes in that God ordained to go into come from the Israelite people to support the various functions. Now, we're not going to talk about what came as a result of the king and the army, because that was just merely taxation. That's all it was. It just plain old taxes. And that's what Samuel said they would do. They would start enacting taxes upon the people in order to supply these things. But what we do have over here, as far as the Levites are concerned, are the tithes. But the tithes aren't the only way that God funded the nation. When Israel became a nation, that there at Mount Sinai, the covenant consisted of the instructions that we find in Exodus chapters 20 through 24. That was the original covenant that God made with Israel. And in that covenant, you see a number of instructions. After Israel accepted that covenant and this blood of the calf was sprinkled on all the people, then Moses went back up on the mountain and he received instructions pertaining to the establishment of the temple or the tabernacle at the time. You got to think about what's going on here. We know that Israel and their fathers, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, they all offered sacrifices, right? They all offered sacrifices on an individual basis. But God, when he drew Israel out of Egypt, all of a sudden you have 600,000 men who need to offer sacrifices. Okay, can that be done without any organization? No, there has to be some organization. So God, from the get-go, I believe, knew that he was going to build the tabernacle, and he knew that he was going to have a priesthood. But the priesthood that God established originally, according to Exodus 19, was the priesthood of the firstborn. And I'm going to call it the Melchizedek priesthood. I believe it was the Melchizedek priesthood. That was the original priesthood of Israel. And they would be serving at the tabernacle based on however it would have worked out. We don't really know, because it never got to that point. We never saw how it worked out. But I would suspect it was going to work out somewhat the same as it did with the Levitical priesthood later on, with the big difference being that the priesthood of Melchizedek was not a full-time priesthood. With all the firstborn up there, they would be serving at various times, but they would still come back to their farms and they would still work their farms. But God did establish, I believe, the priesthood and the tabernacle that was always a part of his plan. And so he had to fund the tabernacle some way in order to take care of those fellows when they were up there working, maybe 2 weeks out of the year, whatever. We don't know how it was going to work. But nevertheless, there still had to be these expenses had to be taken care of. Not only that, you had the morning and evening sacrifice every day, twice on Sabbath. You doubled it on the Sabbath. And so all of these sacrifices had to be paid for, purchased in some way. So God had to have some type of income stream. And so he provided that income stream. And we see that right there at the very beginning in Exodus 20 through 24. God shows us what that income stream is going to be. And we've talked about that already. And the first income stream that we talk about is the firstlings. Right after the firstlings, we talk about and we see the first fruits. And then after that, God shows us the tabernacle offerings, which I don't believe. I can pretty well say that the tabernacle offerings only happened once. And then finally, you had the atonement half shekel, or what's become known as the temple tax. All of these were means by which God was able to take and build the tabernacle, supply for the maintenance of the tabernacle, and supply the income that would be needed to purchase the sacrifices for all the sacrifices for Israel. So let's talk first about this firstlings, the redemption of the firstborn. We see this in beginning in Numbers 3:13. Actually, we saw it today in our Torah study. We saw back in Exodus 13 where God told the Israelites to redeem their firstborn. Okay, we talked a little bit about that then. Well, this goes on here in Numbers 3:13, and it says, "And all the firstborn are mine on the day that I struck down all the firstborn in the land of Egypt. I consecrated for my own all the firstborn in Israel, both of man and beast. They shall be mine. I am Yahweh." So all the firstborn of the animals and the firstborn of the men of the Israelites were set apart for God's purpose. But we have a couple of problems here. Number one, the clean animals can be offered as sacrifices, but what happens to unclean animals? Okay, you can't offer unclean animals as sacrifices, so God said that those could be redeemed. And then also God abhors human sacrifice, and so he said that for all the firstborn males, that they were to be redeemed also. So they were all redeemed, and the redemption, as we'll find out, came up to being 5 shekels of silver. It says, "Every firstborn of a donkey shall be redeemed with a lamb, or if you will not redeem it, you shall break its neck. Every firstborn of man among your sons, you shall redeem." Animals were basically redeemed during the first year, or they were offered as sacrifices. And the redemption price for the redemption was 5 shekels of silver, as it says here in Numbers 18. "And the redemption price at a month old you shall redeem them. You shall fix at 5 shekels of silver according to the shekel of the sanctuary, which is 20 gerahs." So this is the redemption price for a firstborn male son of Israel. They were to be redeemed for these 5 shekels of the silver. And all the redemption money went to the priest. When you look at that, all these passages, you never see that this redemption money ever went to the Levites. They went to the priest. And so we can assume that before the Levitical priesthood and before the Aaronic priesthood, let's call it, before Aaron became priest, then you had the intent was for the 5 shekels of silver to go to the firstborn priest for their service in the tabernacle. Now, there's a little bit of confusion here, and I admit there is confusion, because when you look at the passages from Exodus 24 down through 31 before the sin of the golden calf, you see God talking about Aaron, and that Aaron will be this and his sons will be this. And I've talked about this a few years back, but it's believed by especially Rashi and some of the other leading priests that passage was possibly out of character or out of place that talks about Aaron, or it was simply God saying, "Okay, I know what's going to happen, so this is this. I'm just going to go ahead and say right up front, this is what's going to happen. Aaron's going to become priest." Okay, but it wasn't intended for Aaron to be and his sons to be priests, because at that time that passage is talked about there, I think it's in Exodus about chapter 26, 27, something like that, the firstborn are still the priests of Israel. So we have to look, I think, a little bit beyond that. So this first income stream for the priesthood to support the priesthood, which is the officiating of the sacrifices, would have been the redemption of the firstborn. And as you study those, you'll see that an animal that was not redeemed, in other words, a sheep or a goat, when it was, if it was firstborn, it was taken up to the tabernacle to be sacrificed. It was shared with the priest and the family of the person or the one who brought that particular sacrifice. So that was, again, a way to take and provide for whoever was priest at that time. It was a way to provide for them. They could eat from these animals that were brought up as children were born. And remember, children, when they were born, they had to be redeemed within 30 days. So there was a constant supply of animals coming up that could take and supply for the priest in that time. Going on, it says, all the firstborn males that are born of your herd and your flock, you shall dedicate to Yahweh your God. You shall do no work with the firstborn of your herd, nor shear the firstborn of your flock. You shall eat it, you and your household, before Yahweh your God, year by year, in the place that the Lord shall choose. We just talked about that. This is food for the family and for the priests as they brought them up. Now, the redemption of the firstborn, again, we talked about that a little bit today. When you redeemed your firstborn male in Israel, the redemption did not release him from his role and responsibility as a priest. It just simply redeemed him from being a full-time priest. Remember, the firstborn became God's because of the fact that he saved the firstborn back in the Exodus story. And so they were to become priests. But when they were redeemed, that didn't relieve them from being priests. It just relieved them from the full-time priesthood, because there was no full-time priesthood at that time. They would go serve, and they would serve in their home. They would serve in their community, and they would also serve in the tabernacle. At least that's, I believe, was the intent of what God was doing. Under Yahweh's original plan, there would have been no need for a full-time priesthood, since there would have been so many priests anyway, so many firstborn at that time. So these people, again, they would serve as part-time priests, and when they're not serving at the tabernacle, they would be regular Joes. They would be farmers and ranchers and builders and goldsmiths and all of those things. So that's how the redemption money provided a income stream for the functioning of the community of Israel. The next thing we see is the first fruits. Exodus 23:19 says, the best of the first fruits of your ground you shall bring to the house of Yahweh your God. So this was another means by which you could supply the needs of the tabernacle. Remember, in the tabernacle sacrifices, oftentimes, and I think practically every time you had a sacrifice, you also had to provide a meal sacrifice or a grain offering. So these grain offerings had to be brought and had to be paid for. And so one of the ways of doing this was with the best of the first fruits. Now, as we look into these passages, it becomes a little bit clear that not all of the first fruits were brought. The passage actually says to bring the best of the first fruits, or the first of the first fruits. The word actually is rashit. Rashit, it's the same root word that we have in bereshit. Bereshit. So it could be the first, but it could also be the best of the first fruits. And we know it was not all the first fruits, because God says to bring them in a basket. Just simply to bring the best of the first fruits in a basket and bring them up to the priest. So we see that. That's that picture there. That's the only one I could find of a woman with carrying fruit in her basket. But she's bringing the best of the first fruits up to Jerusalem. It says, you shall take some, and there again the word is reshit, of the first of all the fruit of the ground which you harvest from your land that Yahweh your God has given you, and you shall put it in a basket, and you shall go to the place where Yahweh your God will choose to make his name known there, or dwell there. So the first fruits were brought to the tabernacle, wherever the tabernacle was. And of course, when they went in, got into Israel, the tabernacle was located originally at Shiloh and then moved to Jerusalem. So the first fruits are brought up, and they are to be used by the priest to eat from and to take and do their normal priestly duties, use them in the sacrifices and whatever. Now there's another income stream, and it's called the atonement money or the census atonement money. This is another means of providing income, and there's a little bit of confusion on how this actually applied. Let's just read the passage there. Exodus 30 verse 11 says, "And Yahweh said to Moshe, when you take a census of the people of Israel, then each shall give a ransom for his life. Each one who is numbered in the census shall give this, a half shekel according to the shekel of the sanctuary. Everyone from 20 years old and upward, the rich shall not give more, and the poor shall not give less." So this is they call it the ransom or the atonement for the census. And we know in Scripture that when every time a census was taken, like for instance when David took a census, there was a problem. And a plague came out and killed many of the people. Now there's a couple of passages, one in Numbers and I think another in Deuteronomy, where it doesn't talk about this atonement money being given, but we can assume that it was given since it was a commandment to be given back in Exodus. So for whatever reason, we don't know, counting people was a problem. So Daniel Lancaster, in his in one of his articles in Torah Club, he talks about how the solution to that was to not count people, but count money. And so if you have everybody giving a half shekel, then all you have to do is gather up all the half shekels and count them, and you know how many people are there, right? And so that's one of the reasons why everybody gave the same. If you had someone who was rich and he was giving 10 shekels instead of just a half shekel, then you're going to be there's going to be more people than you think, because you're going to think there's more people because there's more money. So God told everyone to give the same. And by everybody giving a half shekel and by counting the shekels, you would know how many people are there without having to count the people. This is the... This is what they believe actually took place there. By doing it this way, it provided two purposes. It solved two problems. Number one, there again, it kept the plague from attacking or coming on the people and killing the people. But the second thing it did is it gave the persons, each individual person, equal attachment to the tabernacle. So since everybody had paid the same for the purpose here, then they could all equally say they have equally given to the tabernacle. They have equal access to the tabernacle. We know how it is today in most churches and even in synagogues. If you've got someone who's very rich, and I'll say Mitt Romney because we know that he gave $3.5 million in 2 years to the Mormon church, I bet Mitt Romney has pretty good his pick of seats in the Roman tabernacle. We know that in a Jewish synagogue, you can take and buy your seat in the synagogue, and the more you give, the better you get. So God eliminated that problem right from the get-go by saying everybody gives the same, so no one has a better seat than another person. And that was the half shekel there. Now, there's nothing in the Torah that would indicate that the half shekel was given on a regular basis. To assume that there is a regular half shekel tax collected, maybe even year, would indicate that there had been a census every year, since the half shekel was attached to the census. So we don't know that there was a half shekel given every year. We can assume that there was. We know that any time that there was a census taken, though, there would have been a half shekel. And this may be one of the reasons why David's numbering of the people was a problem, because David numbered the people when God apparently showed very clearly, don't number people, you take up a half shekel tax. But maybe because David was already taxing the people pretty bad, he couldn't go ahead and collect another half shekel from them in order to number them. So he tried to do it without collecting the half shekel tax. We don't know. Also, we know that the tabernacle, or the purpose of the half shekel tax, was to take and support the tabernacle. It was to provide various things for the tabernacle. In fact, the original half shekel tax was used to build, to make the sockets for the poles that went all the way around the tabernacle. So the money was used directly for the use of the tabernacle. This is the tax, I believe, that's spoken of in the New Testament when Yeshua is questioned about the temple tax, and, you know, do you pay it? And he gave this thing about the sons, and does the king, you know, the son of the king and all that, does he give it? I think his basic statement, though, was this. By the time of the first century, the Jews had begun collecting the temple tax, or this atonement tax, every year. They apparently assumed that that was the case, and I think they assumed it somewhat justly, though not necessarily. I believe they established a yearly collecting of the temple tax based on something that Nehemiah had started, or basically Ezra had started. When Ezra came back to build the tabernacle or the temple, you know, it says that it says in Nehemiah 10, it says, "And we also took on ourselves the obligation to give yearly a third part of a shekel for the service of the house of God." So what Ezra is doing here, or maybe in Nehemiah, I'm not sure, what he's doing is he's saying, we voluntarily decided we're going to give a third shekel for on a yearly basis in order to support the tabernacle or the temple at that time. Now, Nehemiah was really smart. He took and said it's going to be a third of a shekel instead of a half shekel. So he very clearly separated what he was doing from what the Torah commandment was in order to eliminate any confusion. But I believe, though, because Nehemiah did this, that the rabbis in the first century decided that they could do the same thing. And they could begin to collect this tax on a yearly basis, where more than likely it was not intended to be a yearly thing. And so when you get down to the deal with Yeshua, Yeshua is simply saying, what he's doing, he's saying to avoid offending the political elite, you might say, the Pharisees, I'm going to go ahead and give the tax, even though I know it's not required on a yearly basis. So I'm not sure about that. That's what I believe he's actually talking about there. But anyway, the census atonement money, or the temple tax, was at least a one-time thing that was done in order to help provide for the tabernacle. And later on, in the first century, it was used to provide for the maintenance of the temple. And are we required to do the temple tax today? I don't think so, but I think there will be a time when we will, when God decides to take and number the Israelites again, which I'm sure he'll do sometime down the road. And at that time, he will probably ask us to give a half shekel so he counts the shekels, that doesn't have to count the people. All right. So those are the three income streams that we have up to the time of the golden calf, was the redemption of the firstborn, the first fruits offerings, and possibly a recurring temple tax, though I don't think it was a recurring thing. All right, so now we go on down to the next and the only other way that God provided for an income stream for the people, and that is tithing. Now, we got to keep in mind that tithing came about because of the establishment of the Levitical priesthood. If you go down through Exodus 19, down through chapters 24, and all the way down to the time of the sin of the golden calf, you'll never see tithing mentioned. It's never mentioned. And so you would think that when God's establishing this big nation of his, and he's going to need money for it, and if tithing was going to be part of it, it seems like he would have said so right from the get-go. But he doesn't even mention tithing. You don't see tithing until you get down to the latter part, in fact, the very last chapter of Leviticus. We all know why the priesthood changed from the priesthood of the firstborn to the priesthood of the Levites. Does everybody understand that? Okay. It's because, you know, the The Levites were the only ones that came and stood up for God. The firstborn basically, they never came forward. They didn't do their job. So God replaced them. We see this in Numbers 3, verse 11. And Yahweh spoke to Moshe, saying, "Behold, I have taken the Levites from among the people of Israel instead of every firstborn who opens the womb among the people of Israel. The Levites shall be mine." And they became gods because of the sin of the golden calf. Aaron did not do his job. You know something about Aaron? Aaron was a leader. I mean, he was the brother of Moses. He wouldn't stood up to the Pharaoh, the god of the earth at that time. But yet when it came to these Israelites, he wouldn't stand up to them. So anyway, he ended up becoming high priest, which is not necessarily a good thing. Because you didn't have to be a good person to become priest. And you certainly didn't have to be a good person to become high priest. It was it was just what happened to him. So the Levites become priests in place of the firstborn. Not only did the Levites become priests, but they became a full-time priesthood. They no longer had an inheritance. They didn't get an inheritance in the land. They didn't have the opportunity to be full-time farmers, though they did have Levitical cities where they could do farming as a sideline thing. They never had the opportunity like the other Israelites had of having their own lands and being full-time farmers, ranchers, or whatever. So because they became full-time priests, then there had to be a way to support them. And the way God chose to do that was through tithing. There again, it was not part of the original economic system that God had set up. And it was not intended, tithing was not intended to be a way of taking care of the poor either, because the poor were already taken care of. We talked about that already. The poor had already been taken care of. So let's look at some of these passages pertaining to tithing. We're not going to get into all the little nitty-gritty of it. But it says this: "Every tithe of the land, whether the seed of the land or the fruit of the trees, is Yahweh's. It is holy to Yahweh." So first thing we see about tithing is that tithing is of the seed of the land and the fruit of the trees. We'll also see a passage where it talks about how ranchers and shepherds were to give a tithe. But what we don't see is anything pertaining to money. In fact, if you wanted to take and convert your tithe to money, you had to add 20% to it. God didn't want your money. He wanted your tithe. He wanted the tenth part of what you had gained from your sharecropping relationship between God and the people. He just wanted the produce, because it was produce that people can eat. People can't eat money. He wanted the produce so that he could feed the Levites. There again, if you wanted to redeem it, you had to add a fifth of the value to it, as it says there in Leviticus 27:31. It's also interesting that the tithe was not the first tenth of your produce. It was the tenth of the produce, as we can see in the case of the herdsman. And every tithe of the herds and the flocks, every tenth animal of all that pass under the herdsman's staff shall be holy to Yahweh. So if you have a herd of sheep out here, or a flock of sheep out here, and you have 9 new sheep come along, and say your flock was originally 30 sheep, now you got 39 sheep, so you have an increase of 9 sheep, what was your tithe? It was nothing. You never did tithe on the first. You always tithe on the tenth. And so if you're a sharecropping there with God, and God gives you a field, and your field is, you normally get, say, 100 bushels off this field, and this year you only got 110 bushels off this field, what was your increase? It was none. You didn't get you had an increase of 9, but you didn't have a tenth. And so I would suggest that you had no tithe. Now, I could be wrong on that, because whereas you could not divide animals up, you can divide bushels of grain. So possibly you could then give a tithe of that. But it's not necessarily shown to be true in the scripture here. The big point of this, though, is that you were not to tithe on money. Money was never to be tithed on. So farmers, ranchers tithe. Fishermen, goldsmiths, builders did not tithe. The servant who worked for the farmer did not tithe. The reason he didn't tithe is because he didn't have any land. He didn't own any land. He was paid wages, but he did not own any land. And therefore, the sharecropping, he didn't have a sharecropping relationship with God. The wage earner never did pay tithes. And, you know, you look at God's thinking on this, and I'm going to say it's God's thinking. I believe it is. But, you know, as a sharecropper, and God's responsibility to the Israelites was that he was going to provide the rain, he was going to provide the land, and they were going to provide the work. So if God didn't give the rain, then they weren't going to have as much. And God would say, okay, I didn't provide you the rain, so I'm not expecting anything from you this year. Okay? So it's sort of a two-way street that God has that when he's working with you. There, you know, I said this earlier today, God is very balanced in these things. It's sort of a contractual thing. God keeps everything balanced. Everything stays even. And then the tithe was given to the Levites. To the Levites I have given every tithe in Israel for an inheritance in return for their service that they do, their service in the tent of meeting. So a person could not receive tithes if he didn't satisfy two requirements. And those two requirements are very clear here. They have to be a Levite and they have to be serving in the tabernacle in some degree. All right? So if their service, the Levites didn't all serve at the tabernacle all the time. Sometimes they served in their own local area. I think this still applied to them also. But if you weren't a Levite, you did not receive the tithe. So, were the firstborn of Israel in Exodus 19, could they receive the tithe? No, they weren't. They couldn't because they weren't Levites. They may have been Ephraimites, they may have been Judahites, they may have been Gadites, but they weren't Levites. Only the Levites can receive the tithe. So there's tithing is taught in practically every church. There for a long time I thought we were the only ones ever tithe. Boy, I was wrong. Everybody teaches tithing out there. And they all try to somehow squirrel their way into this Levite thing, so that they can claim the tithe, because they know that's what the scripture says. So they try to somehow get themselves into that. And I think that's the basis for this whole spiritual Israel thing, is that if you're a spiritual Israelite, then maybe I'm a spiritual Levite, you know? I don't know. But God is very clear about tithing. The Levites were the only ones that could receive the tithes. And it's interesting that the priests themselves could not receive the tithes. An Israelite, if I had a tithe and I had a basket full of my tithes and I wanted to take it up to Jerusalem, I could not take it up to Jerusalem and give it to a priest. I had to give it to the Levites. Now, granted, the priests were all Levites, but the tithe went to the non-priestly Levite first. And then the non-priestly Levite would take a tenth of that and give it to the priest. So for me to take and say, Martinez is a son of Aaron, if I were to take my tithes and give it to Martinez, I would be violating the Torah, because the Torah said I couldn't give it to him. I could only give it to a Levite who was not a priest. And then that Levite would then give a portion of the tithe to Martinez. Another thing to consider is that since tithing was tied to the land, In other words, you only gave agricultural products. Then on the Shemitah year, the year of release, the seventh year, the land Sabbath, nobody got any tithes, at least not from the ground, because the farmer didn't sow, the farmer didn't reap, so therefore the farmer had no tithes. So he could not, the farmer could not give tithes on that seventh year, nor could the Levites receive tithes on that seventh year. So therefore they had to be a little bit prudent in how they took care of the tithes that were given to them, because they would have to last for a while, especially on the sixth year. We'll get into that. It says, and this pertains to the third and the sixth year. It talks about an additional tithe or a redirection of tithe. It says, you shall seek the place the Lord your God will choose you, and there you shall bring your burnt offerings and your sacrifices, your tithes and the contribution that you present, your vow offerings and your freewill offerings, and the firstborn of your herd and your flock. This passage here is talking about where you were to take the tithes. The tithes were to be taken to Jerusalem. And there they were given, like I said, directly to the Levites. And I believe at the beginning, when this all started, they were given to the Levites, and the Levites basically dispersed them amongst themselves at that time. Later on, we see an example in Nehemiah of the tithes being brought to a storehouse and stored in a storehouse. So they may have developed that process later in order to take and get over the problem that would come about as a result of the third and the sixth and seventh years, where there was, I believe, no tithe taken to Jerusalem. So, but the point being here is that the tithes, along with the first fruits offerings, along with the firstlings, those were all taken to Jerusalem. And for most people, the only time they went to Jerusalem was during the festivals. So this is the way I believe it took place. They would all go up there and they would take their tithes up there on a yearly basis. And this would be an indication why there could be three tithes, because there was three pilgrimage festivals based on three different harvests. So in the spring, you took the tithe of that crop, went to Jerusalem. In the summertime, Shavuot, you took the tithe of that crop and took it to Jerusalem. And in the fall, you took the tithe of that crop and went to Jerusalem. So you had three tithes. And because the Jews, they're really mixed up about this, about how the tithing was done. You'll read one area where there's two tithes, one area there's three tithes, and then some of the Jews still believe there's only one tithe. So there's a lot of question there. And then it goes on to the third and the sixth year, and it says, when you have finished paying the tithe of your produce in the third year, which is the year of tithing, giving it to the Levite, the sojourner, the fatherless, and the widow, so that you may eat within the towns and be filled, then you shall say, and then it has a big long prayer that you're supposed to say. So from this passage here in Deuteronomy, and remember, Deuteronomy is the second giving of the Torah. It's Moses must have seen this in what was given before in order to be saying this right now. But what he is seeing here is on the third and the sixth year, that the tithe was kept in the local area, and then it was given to the Levites, the sojourner, the fatherless, and the widow. Notice it doesn't say anything about giving it to the poor. It talks about the sojourner. That's probably someone coming through, doesn't have a job necessarily, passing through, wanting to establish himself in Israel, having a hard time getting started maybe. So you're going to help this person out for a while. The fatherless and the widow, that would come about as a result of maybe a man who is killed in battle. And so he leaves behind a child and a wife. They're not necessarily poor. They don't fit in that same category as the poor who got themselves into a bad situation. This is a situation where, you know, this person, for whatever reason, they don't have a father. These people were to be taken care of and helped out. And this was what this tithe of the third year was to be for. Notice also that it says, let me just read it here. It says, I may say it the same way up there. Yeah. When you have finished paying all the tithe of the produce of the third year, which is in the year of the tithing, which is the year of tithing, giving it to the Levite, the sojourner of the fathers. Notice that the person who is bringing the tithe gives it to the Levite, the sojourner, the fatherless, and the widow. He doesn't give it to the Levite for the Levite to distribute it out. He is responsible for taking and making sure that money is divvied out to the people who are in need in his community. What we're seeing here is that tithing was supposed to be a very local thing, at least on the third of the sixth year. It was local. You took that tithe and you used that money to take and help these people out that you knew of needed help. So this is the what is sometimes called the third tithe. All right, well, there's a number of other things that we could talk about on tithing, but we're not going to get into those things. We'll do it some other time because there's a lot of little nitty-gritty things that we need to understand about tithing to help us to get a good grasp of what our role in tithing is today as non-Levites and not being a part of the priesthood. We're not going to talk about that, but I just want to wrap up now the whole Torah economics thing by going through some points here that we've discussed so that we can see how God's tithing and system of helping people out all worked. There again, come up here. Yahweh's economic principles are simply this: take care of the poor. It's called Zedekah. And as we saw a few weeks ago, Zedekah means righteousness. So it's your righteousness. Your righteousness is expressed in how you take care of the poor. And it's done predominantly on a local level. Everything we see in Scripture in regards to taking care of the poor is on a local level. It's never done in a big governmental system. Your way of taking care of the poor is by providing them meaningful work. Is basically it. You don't give them anything. You provide them meaningful work. Even if it's just by leaving the corners of your field, you're still providing them meaningful work. And the purpose for giving them meaningful work is to maintain their dignity. And then also, you are required to not impose any undue burden on the poor when helping them out. In other words, you could not give them interest. You always had to pay them on time. Another aspect of Yahweh's economic principles was to provide for the tabernacle, and that was done through offerings and various forms of maintenance, maybe the temple tax or whatever that's it might be. But it's predominantly through offerings and through the first fruits offerings and the redemption for the firstborn. And then as time went on, as a result of the sin of the golden calf, not what God intended, but bottom line is we ended up with the priesthood being given to the Levites, and therefore there was a requirement on the Israelites to provide for those who work in the temple, and that is through the tithes. So this is, in a nutshell, God's economic system. This is how I see it all worked out. And if you're interested, sometime we'll do another talk and get it down on some of the nitty-gritty points of tithing. There's a lot more in the Scripture that we can find in regards to that. But for right now, this will suffice. And so I hope we all see that God had a very good system, a very non-overbearing system on the people, and a system that basically relied upon personal responsibility in order to take and finance the work that he was doing through Israel.